You're listening to Practically Ideal.
Welcome to Practically Ideal, the podcast for idealists who like to keep it practical. I'm your host, Logan Bowe, podcasting from Chicago, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Bob Caswell, in Seattle. How you doing, Bob?
Hanging in there, doing okay.
Today we'll talk about conscious capitalism and respond to some reader comments. We'll also talk about Google releasing its own phone and Chrome operating system in Bob's Tech Report. And our pop culture update will tackle the Tiger Woods saga and also deal with some movies we've seen. Let's rock. Bob, how's your week been?
Oh, it's been fine. I am ready for the holidays and I have a cold right now, but I'm actually grateful that I have it now instead of during the holidays. At least in theory, I plan to be sick for another day or two and then be perfectly fine for the holidays.
Nicer to go into work when you're sick than to have to party and exchange gifts, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And since my job allows me to call into meetings if I need to, that's probably what I'll do for a day or two. So it shouldn't be too bad.
That does sound nice.
Yeah, how about you? Anything new and exciting this week?
Actually, it's been a fairly eventful week. Finals have been done for Amy, so we've hit the town a little bit more than we have. We've seen a couple movies, went to the Art Institute of Chicago, which is kind of their big-time museum
here.
I hit the Modern Wing. That's where I went straight to. You know, I'm the kind of person who likes my arts and culture, at least my fine arts and culture, to be around 100 years old or less.
Is it more accessible that way, or just...
Actually, quite the opposite, usually. Like, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the snob in me. Not that I'm some fantastic, you know, art appreciator. I'm really just a casual art fan. But, you know, like my classical music, if you get much older than Mahler, you know, I just start to get bored. Or books. I cannot read a book that's more than 100 years old. You know, I've tried some Charles Dickens. I just cannot get through that. So I don't know what it is.
Well, isn't stuff like Charles Dickens assigned in high school? I figure that we all got our reading quota of like 1800s-esque books back then.
Oh, but that's definitely what I feel. But a lot of people love Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, you know, people from that era. But I just can't do it. I need my Philip Roth or my Jonathan Safran Foer or people a lot more recent.
Well,
anyway.
With books, though, they are more accessible, or at least it's the opposite of what you were talking about with art. Books make more sense, at least to me, the more recent they're written. With art, I feel like next time I'm in the modern wing of any sort of museum, I'm going to have you along because I need some help with that, man. It's hard for me.
Yeah, check it out. I mean, I like it. They had some of the regular people you'd suspect, like some Pollocks and some Kandinskys. Also some other people who were less famous. And like, I mean, like I said, I'm just a casual fan, so I, you know, promptly forgot the names of some of the artists I saw, but some interesting things. And it was fun. That's the type of stuff I like.
I'm almost more of a practically ideal appreciator of art. Like, I like zoomed in pictures of flowers and stuff. I don't know. That's
okay.
A random example. Rather than like splashes of paint on a wall and it's like, oh, do you turn it this way or this way? It doesn't really matter because it's modern.
Yeah, okay. So the modern and contemporary stuff may not be your cup of tea, which is totally fine. I completely get that. But for some reason, I really like it.
No, that's cool. That's cool. Mostly, I don't understand it.
Yeah, and I guess I like to pretend that I'm cool enough to understand it when I'm really just talking out my ass about it anyway. But
well, your secret's safe
I get
with
a kick
me.
Out of it. Awesome. And then the other thing is we went to a Christmas burlesque review last night. So we've had a fun night. That was a good time.
Wow, a Christmas burlesque review. Wow, that's one way to be cheerful and in the spirit. Go to a burlesque show.
Yeah, and it was very Christmassy. That's someone playing Santa and a lot of Christmassy costumes and songs. Yeah, maybe that's enough about that. Okay, so we have a couple announcements today. First off, we'll be taking a week off next week. Next week, there will be no podcast due to the holidays, which in our cases are both the Christmas celebrations. But, you know, we want to be inclusive, so we'll call it the holidays.
That's right.
The second is Bob wants everyone to know that his mic isn't the mic that he usually uses. So if the sound quality isn't up to our standards, he apologizes. And next week will be in full effect.
Exactly. Last podcast of the year, and it's a bit of a crappy mic. Long story that's not that exciting. But it'll be better next year.
Capitalism has gotten a bad rap these days. It's very trendy to talk in the media or at cocktail parties or whatever, as though a profit motive is completely incompatible with any public or social benefit. Intellectual defenders of capitalism, on the other hand, they talk about the only aim of business should be to maximize shareholder value. For example, in 1970, Milton Friedman wrote, famously, that there is one and only one social responsibility of business: to use its resources and engage in activities designed to increase its profits so long as it stays within the rules of the game, which is to say, engages in open and free competition without deception or fraud. In other words, philanthropy, social responsibility, good corporate citizenship, etc., are justified if and only if they help increase long-term profits. This is pretty much the dominant mainstream orthodox paradigm for business ethics today. I mean, for one thing, it's still taught in business school, right? I mean, Bob, you've recently been to business school. Is profit maximization the view that they talk about there?
Yeah, it still is the dominant view. I went to business school from 2006 to 2008. That's when I got my MBA. And this new realm of thinking that includes other things other than maximizing shareholder value, it's given some time too, but not nearly as much time. And it's almost kind of an inside joke because, well, how do I want to put it? The joke is that maximizing shareholder value includes those other things. So when somebody who says maximizing shareholder value isn't enough, business professors like to point out that these people, these skeptics, just assume that maximizing shareholder value is only referring to one thing, but that as long as the structure is set up correctly around it, maximizing shareholder value does include philanthropy and what are some of the other stuff? Eco-friendly behavior, perhaps, and
corporate citizenship or things like that.
Corporate citizenship, yeah. All of that falls into the category of maximizing shareholder value in the long run if we're playing in a system that supports that, which in theory we are in the United States. But I'm not going to say one way or the other at this point. Well, it's just hard to say if that's the case in a wide sweeping way. It is and it isn't, depending on what you're looking at, I suppose.
I'm really glad you brought that up because I think people like Milton Friedman, who said or who wrote the thing I just read, would share that exact same view, that if you really understand maximizing long-term shareholder value, that includes all those other things.
Exactly.
And my response is yes and no. Theoretically, yes, but somehow not in practice so much. But that's exactly the type of thing we're going to talk about more. I wanted to also talk about the profit maximization view in terms of my training, which is legal training in law school.
Ah.
I'm not an expert in corporate law, but I had a class or two in it. And from what I understand, legally, there's a fiduciary duty on behalf of the people who run a corporation toward their shareholders. And this extends to the point that if the people who run the corporation are not doing things that look like they're maximizing long-term shareholder value, shareholders can actually sue the company and force the company to take certain actions, maybe to make some personnel changes or things like that. So this idea that the aim of business is to maximize shareholder value is actually enshrined in the legal system, not only in business school classrooms.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. That's a really interesting take because a lot of times the business world or corporate America is attacked for doing things the wrong way or after the whole bailout financial system fiasco. Everybody has an opinion of how the system is broken. But at the same time, you can't just blame the men in suits, men and women in suits at the top necessarily, because they're just being held responsible to the shareholders, which can be anyone and everyone, less
right.
So than just a finite number of people that actually go to that building for work.
Both legally and as a result of the culture surrounding business responsibilities.
Right.
You know, I just want to say again, and this is kind of what you said before, in fairness, defenders of traditional capitalism don't advocate, you know, illegal behavior or destruction of the environment or exploitation of workers, etc. But as you said, they say that the market will take care of all that if they just seek profits, kind of the invisible hand at work by voluntary exchange between people and corporations. All those things get factored into the price of goods and the stock price as well.
Yeah, something like that.
So there are a couple things to say about that. For one, even if that's true, the way it's framed makes it easy to view corporations as inherently greedy and uncaring. For that reason alone, it might be better for corporations to talk about what they did in different terms. And I also want to say that, obviously, profits are a crucial focus for businesses. They're absolutely proper focus, and they're a necessary focus. If you're not making profits, you're not going to be able to do anything else.
Right. I guess where I get hung up is this idea of triple bottom line or more than profits being the goal of businesses. And people are talking about it as if it's a new thing. If I'm going to put on my skepticism hat, I'm going to say, yeah, businesses have had PR departments for a long time. To me, this is just a rebranding of public relations.
And the multiple bottom lines is?
Yeah, maybe there's more to it than that you want to elaborate on. But if we're just talking about how businesses need to do other things because they're better for everyone all around, businesses businesses already feel that to a certain degree and hire lots of really smart people to deal with their image and are generally doing things to manage that. But perhaps it's not enough. I'm not sure what else needs to be included so that people give more credibility to businesses being legitimate. I guess in this day and age, with the financial sector screwing it up for the rest of us, it's needed more so. But to me, it's like, oh, just make your PR department a little bigger. But you don't necessarily have to fundamentally restructure the way you account for things and what you're in business for. That seems kind of a bigger deal than what's actually needed.
Well, I'm really glad you brought up multiple bottom lines. That's, in fact, one of the things I wanted to talk about as we move on more. It's interesting you talk about the PR departments. I think there's a thing that could be said there. For one, there is PR to make people think that you have other purposes or you have other goals, but then there's the actually investing time and effort in the other goals. So just because your branding says you're one thing doesn't mean you actually are that one thing, and there could be perhaps a tension there.
Right. I guess perception being reality can only get you so far. Eventually, there needs to be some backing to it.
Right. And I really love John Mackey on this. You're going to find the more you listen to this podcast that John Mackey is one of my favorite people. I was going to say this at the beginning, but I'll just say it now, that I'm really excited to do conscious capitalism as a topic on the podcast in the first place, because this is one of the things that I'm really passionate about. In one respect, a lot of the groundwork that we've laid up till now is just to make it so there's a foundation that we've set so we can talk about something like conscious capitalism. It's one of the things that I do want to put my energy behind. The other thing is that it's an area where I might depart from mainstream libertarianism a little bit more than other parts. So that's always fun to get that. For example, what we've talked about, like Milton Friedman, you can't get more libertarian than him, as he talked about the only social aim of business should be to maximize profits. I like thinking of it slightly differently. So already I'm departing from libertarians a little bit. Okay, so that's my spiel. And John Mackey. If you don't know John Mackey, he's the CEO of Whole Foods. And I love him because on the one hand, he's this crunchy granola hippie. And on the other hand, he's a hardcore free market libertarian, you know, multi-billion dollar corporation CEO. So I love that sort of dual personality there.
Definitely.
Anyway, he talks about two fundamental changes that need to be implemented to the paradigm. And again, I want to say that I'm really focusing on the paradigm. These aren't tremendous changes to a business practices. They're subtle, and they're to the way that we think about business. Okay. First, most great companies have a purpose deeper than maximizing shareholder value. But we can only, for whatever reason, talk about their purpose of maximizing shareholder value. And if businesses would embrace their deeper purpose and go after it and publicize it, I think that would be better for society and better for corporations. Let me explain what I mean. Most professions, in addition to making money, do have other purposes, and we're quite comfortable thinking of it that way. For example, you know, doctors, they set up their practice, they want to make money, obviously, but they also have the purpose to heal people. Teachers, they have the purpose to teach people. Lawyers have the purpose to pursue justice for their clients. These are other purposes that these professions have in addition to wanting to make money. And we're totally comfortable acknowledging the dual purpose of making money and having this other purpose for those professions. So why can't we be comfortable with that for corporations? The
wow.
other thing is,
I'll save it.
Okay, cool. And lots of corporations actually do have purposes in addition to profits. For example, let's look at Google. They famously have their motto, "Don't be evil." You know, we could talk about how well they live up to that, but it's a guiding principle beyond just maximizing shareholder value. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think it also gives them part of their personality and their characteristic, you know, what makes them special. And also, broadly, I think you could say that Google has the purpose of making information more widely available and accessible, which
yeah.
seems to drive what they do, in addition to wanting to maximize their profits. And I think that drives a lot of what they do. So some historical examples, you know, Henry Ford, in addition to being a very wealthy tycoon, he also had the purpose to transform society by making cars more affordable. And he did that. More recently, Microsoft did the same thing by helping make computers everywhere. So in addition to making their profits, they transform society. Apple seems to have a philosophy of comprehensive aesthetic design in addition to, you know, making a lot of money.
Well, so you're bringing up a lot of good contemporary examples. So what's the problem? I feel like it's not as obvious. You can't just say teachers teach. Doctors heal people. Business people, and then blank. It could be any number of things. I think it's just that nobody has the time to go through and figure out the unlimited number of ways you can change the world and make money in business. Is that what we're missing? That's just me playing devil's advocate. Or do you feel like you're only giving the handful of examples where there is that blank filled in and the rest of corporate America has the blank still blank?
Well, let me put it this way. I think it will be different for every corporation. But, you know, you're an entrepreneur. And, you know, some entrepreneurs think, you know, I'm going to start this business just to make as much money as I can. But, you know, that's fine if they want to do that. I mean, I've got nothing against them doing that. But if you look at the successful entrepreneurs who have started great companies, usually it's they have a purpose that they want this to happen in the world. Even something like be their own boss, or they want to improve service in this sort of area. They go into business for reasons that include but are not completely explained by maximizing profits. You know what I mean?
I totally agree. And I think I would say the majority of entrepreneurs are like that. And it's a very small number of people who are like, hey, I'm going to stop my job because I think I can make a crap load of money faster and easier by doing it on my own. Maybe
exactly.
There are some people like that, but I'm still kind of stuck on wondering if this paradigm shift hasn't already happened to a certain degree in the last 20, 50, 100 years. I don't know when the cutoff would be since the Industrial Revolution, but who are the companies we're talking about that don't have this figured out or that need to change or that need to put on a different set of glasses and view the world in a different way?
Well, that's the thing. I think most companies are doing this. Certainly most of the great and most successful companies are doing this. It's the way we think about business that keeps us from emphasizing this. It's like intellectual defenders or corporations can always come back to, listen, all we have to do is make profits for our shareholders. That's all you can hold us responsible for. Yeah, and they say, no, if we talk about maximizing shareholder value, that includes purpose. We don't need to talk about purpose. So it kind of cuts both ways. When it's to your advantage, you can talk about it. When it's not, you can pretend like it doesn't exist. But if we were to think about the purpose, and it was more normal for purpose to be embraced and the flag of their purpose waved by corporations, it's just the way we talk about and think about business that would change, I think.
I think a lot of that might happen behind the scenes in different ways as different corporations quantify these other purposes. And what I mean by that is if your main purpose of being in business is to maximize shareholder value, all these other things have to be viewed in equal terms, or else it's very hard to justify them or not justify them. So there isn't a universal way to quantify social responsibilities or multiple bottom lines that is externally acceptable across the industry, whereas there are universal ways to quantify profits and net present values and return on investments and payback periods and all those typical financial measures. So maybe it would be helpful if we could establish a way to do an apples-to-apples view of how businesses could incorporate this into what they already have, rather than everybody sort of doing it in their own flavor on their own terms, and it sort of gets lost in the shuffle and we don't hear about it as much.
I think that'd be tremendously helpful. I'm really glad you brought that up. If people were taking this seriously and there came to be standards of how to take care of your employees or take care of the environment or what have you, then it'd be a lot easier to measure and to pursue. I'm totally with you.
I guess maximizing shareholder value, since it's easier to quantify, we can measure the risks and the pros and cons of profits today or a year from now or 10 years from now. Then with these other things, since we can't talk about them in the same terms, we can't quantify them in the same way, they're more kind of warm fuzzies, and it's hard to know how many warm fuzzies equals a dollar today or a dollar tomorrow.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, what you're talking about is it seems like measurement and forecasting and just analytical problems with all these things other than money, because we've got 1,000 years or more of experience, you know, accounting for where our money's coming in and where it's going out, and we don't have that with the other things.
Right. So I think that would be the first step. One other thing I wanted to point out on this topic, you may have plenty more to say about while I'm thinking of it. One of my issues with conscious capitalism is the fact that a lot of people seem interested in it as a goal. And to me, it feels less like something you do and more like the way you do something. It's sort of like growing up and saying as a kid that when you grow up, you want to be a consultant. It's like, what does that mean? Like, you still need to pick a profession or have an area of expertise or have a good idea, start a business that makes you stand out from the crowd, makes it so people want to buy your stuff over other people's stuff. So to say like, hey, I'm going to join the socially responsible movement, it's almost like premature if you're not already in business or haven't already thought up business in the traditional sense. So this feels very much like an ancillary thing that is a good thing, but I guess I take issue with the movement focusing so much on it that it's like, oh, the ideas will come later.
That's a good point. What we need is businesses who are already good at something to embrace this, not kids out of college. Oh, what do you want to do now that you've graduated? Oh, I want to be a conscious capitalist.
Right. And you want to change the world and make global warming go away and like all the unachievable idealistic things, which we want to be more practical here, right?
That's right. No, that's an excellent point. It takes real competency. It takes a great business to be great at conscious capitalism, not just a conscious person who's crappy at business.
Well, good. If we agree on that, then you could sign me up on trying to get this thing through in some ways.
Cool. All right. So the other thing that I want to talk about is in terms of shifting the paradigm a little bit is that the metaphor of labor, land, and capital as the factors of production is outmoded. But we try to shove business theory into that a little bit. And this is kind of what you're talking about before. And it's not necessarily new, but something like multiple bottom lines, or I guess even more than that, a stakeholder model is what I'm getting at here. So the old view of land, labor, and capital combining for the outputs, it doesn't account for new things that we've discovered, like systems interdependencies, or relationships, or externalities, or things like that.
Sure.
And going to a stakeholder model does take those into account. And there's been at least one book that has tried hard to study what it's like when companies embrace more of a stakeholder model. And, you know, it'd be great if there were a lot more people studying it. But what they discovered is that companies who, well, for one, they're great companies, which, as we talked about, is important. But for another, part of what makes them great is that they do embrace the stakeholder model. So they're very concerned about their employees as an end in themselves, not only as profit maximizers. They're very invested in their contribution to the environment or the relationship with their suppliers or how they fit into the countries and the communities they live in. And what they found, the Firms of Endearment study, was that companies that do that tend to be among the very most profitable. So it's what John Mackey calls the paradox of profits. If you focus on the whole system of relationships that profits come out of, then your profits will actually tend to increase. So you have to go kind of indirectly. He compares it to happiness, to where if you just say, I'm going to do something that makes me happy today, it's harder to do than if you do something oblique to being happy, then all of a sudden, happiness is a byproduct.
Wow. To put on my skeptic hat one more time.
Awesome.
Sometimes with these studies, though, I don't know if you're familiar with the book Good to Great, which is...
Jim Collins, right?
Yeah, Jim Collins, and it's this monumental business book that I purposely avoided just because I read another book that kind of did an analysis of Good to Great, among other things. It wasn't just focused on a rebuttal, but it was bigger than that. But the point is that in Good to Great, there's all these companies that are analyzed, and it's like, what makes these companies great instead of just good? And it turns out that this other book I read, which analyzes these companies on a different level, shows that Good to Great is only picking out the companies that actually did make it to great. And in fact, there are plenty of companies who have the same characteristics as the great companies but failed. But we don't go hunting for them or searching for them. We just start with, okay, here are the great companies and let's look at the good characteristics of them. And then we assume that that's the reason they are great rather than like forgetting that, well, that doesn't outrule the possibility of other companies having gone through the same path and failing. And I'm wondering, this may be a little too nuanced, but I'm wondering if the studies that you're referring to about having these multiple bottom lines, if in fact there are other companies that have had multiple bottom lines and tried it and failed, but we don't look at those ones. We're only looking at the ones that have succeeded and showing the system is, you know, how it works.
Listen, you bring up a fantastic point, and I want to fully grant that point and not overplay the evidence that we're working with, because it's one book, and I totally realize that. It'd be fantastic for other people to analyze the same sorts of data or to do their own research to either back up or make their research be modified in some helpful way. I'd totally be open for that. So I don't want to overplay the hand. So here's what I will say, though, that I think we can take from that. In many cases, having a stakeholder model is extremely consistent with very high profits.
Okay.
I feel like that's pretty safe to say. Companies like Whole Foods, John Mackey's, take a very explicit, you know, multiple bottom lines stakeholder model, and they've been extremely profitable as a company. Or other ones are in the Firms of Endearment book, like Starbucks or REI or various others that do things like have their deep purpose. They credit a lot of the things that they do, having aims and focuses beyond just maximizing shareholder profits. A lot of these companies, and this one group of people who studied it, say that they actually focus on other things. So that kind of goes against the profit maximizing credo, that you can only focus on shareholder profits. They focus on them not as means to an end, but as ends in and of themselves. And they say that by doing that, they do have the effect of maximizing shareholder value. So that kind of goes back to what your business school professor said, that, yeah, if you do it right, you end up maximizing shareholder value. So if that's your goal, then you're doing it either way.
Well, you're saying that, because I think the key difference is the means versus the end. Because my professors would say that it's a means to an end. Yeah, you do those things and it's part of the end goal of maximizing shareholder value. But you're saying these different goals that you go for are ends in and of themselves, and then the byproduct can be more maximization of shareholder value, and it's a totally separate work stream, if you will, rather than part of the same work stream of maximizing shareholder value. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm getting at. And I feel like it's kind of a subtle thing, but it's also different than just investing more money in your PR department to advertise about how cool of a company you are.
Sure. So then the question for you, Logan, is do you feel like we need something external to come in? And are these incentives for doing this just not analyzed and studied well enough? Do you and I need to go back and get our PhDs and prove to the business world that they're missing out on something? Or is this the type of thing that it's kind of a grassroots thing, and you think the next generation of entrepreneurs and businesses and stuff like that is going to start embracing this? I'm just trying to figure out how this goes about being baked into business.
That's a fantastic question. To hem and haw a little bit around the edges, first let me say that I'm not necessarily entirely opposed to some sort of external impetus being placed on business. I mean, for example, one of the things that I'm hypothetically open to is adjusting the ways that shareholders or other stakeholders could have legal recourse against a company instead of just privileging the shareholder maximization. I mean, that's an idea. I'm not exactly sure how it would work. Point is that maybe some external things could be done. But one of the great things about business and the free market system is that the feedback is fast and it's powerful. So when people disagree with John Mackey, for example, he says, cool, let's compete. And if businesses in enough sectors and enough businesses, as we talked about, that are great businesses and also do it this other way, start to outcompete, then it'll happen in a hurry. And there are a few examples of businesses that are shining examples of this conscious capitalism model. And it's happening slowly, you know, it takes a little while to build up momentum, but at the very least, they're gaining a toehold that seems to be strengthening, not weakening. And I like to think that at some point, people are just going to start to realize that, wait a second, maybe there's a better way to think about it that isn't necessarily revolutionizing things. As I've talked about, it's pretty similar, but there are some differences. I think that those will take hold pretty quickly, to be honest. At least I like to hope so. That's the idealist in me. And then, you know, I'm always open to ideas to bring me back down to earth and make it a little more practical.
I like it. Well, here's hoping things happen. It'll be fun to watch it evolve. And I really like John Mackey's approach of just saying, all right, let's compete, because the feedback loop in business is very fast to react. We'll see where it goes.
So that's the hope.
Practically Ideal. Politics, technology, pop culture.
In the last few weeks since we started the podcast, we've had a few listeners comment on the blog. And if you'd like to comment on what you hear today or anything you hear in the future, you can do so too. Visit elbeaux.com, elbeaux.com, and give us a comment. And if it's good, we'll read it on the podcast. Today, we're going to deal with comments to our very first podcast. One of them comes from Mark. He says, I'm a self-proclaimed left-leaning moderate. While I acknowledge for a lot of people this can be a cop-out, for me, it's more about where I tend to fall on the issues and less about the lack of strength or passion in my opinions. I'm more conservative on some issues and less conservative on others. By and large, though, I tend not to be incredibly ideological on a lot of specific issues, and my views tend to be centrist when compared to the polls. Now, you, Bob, you were the one who especially called out moderates, right? Do you want to take this
one? Right. Sure. So left-leaning moderate, Mark, huh? So here's the issue. By saying that, you're quantifying all the issues in your head in your own Mark sort of way and netting out by saying you're left-leaning. I don't know if certain issues are more important or if you're equally weighting them all, but you can't have your cake and eat it too, in my opinion. If you're really all over the place, then you're just going to have to deal with being all over the place. But giving yourself a label using your own measurement system that nobody else knows, that's the problem with the way moderates usually are. You have your conservative moderates or your liberal moderates, and they pretend like, well, or maybe not pretend, that's a strong word, but they say, I lean more this way than that way, but I'm also the other way on lots of issues too, so don't rule it out. And I guess it's sort of like saying, I'm a good person, but when I'm not. I don't know. I don't know that it's... a helpful label, but maybe it's not that strong of a thing to get my panties all in a bunch about, but I will anyway.
Nice, I like it. I have a few things to say, because I don't know if I came out quite as strongly as you did, but I definitely resist the term moderate myself too. There are a couple things for me about this, and I'm glad Mark brought this up. For one, I will admit that partially it's just a personality thing. I feel like when you say moderate, what you're doing is you're defining yourself by the extremes on each side, and so it's kind of a derivative position that you stake out for yourself, and my personality just doesn't like that. But if that's cool for Mark, if he likes that, fine, he can do that. But the other thing I want to say is, one of the things that I feel like we've come back to quite often on this podcast is the idea of being defined by your positions, you know, just a constellation of positions that you plot on a graph. What I'm more interested in is your point of view. You know, if you don't have a coherent point of view, then you're not the kind of person I want to invite to the policy setting party. You know, I'd love to get a room full of people like, let's say, Paul Krugman on one side. We'll get Cornel West to back him up, maybe Tyler Cowen, and we'll bring Milton Friedman back from the dead. Now, that's going to be a room you want to be in. There's going to be a lot of creative shit going on in there, and they're going to come up with some cool things because they'll have strong points of view. If you get four or five moderates, that's, you know, let's pass out the cookies, let's say how cool we are for being moderates, and then let's go home and not have anything new to say.
Yeah. No, that's... Well, I want to agree with you, and I do. I feel like I need to point out that by doing so, I feel almost a little hypocritical, because it's not like I'm super gung-ho Mr. Political Activist guy in the room either. I tend to be moderate in action, even if I'd like to think that I'm more than moderate on issues, even if my actions don't reflect that. So for what that's worth. And I do have to say, in Mark's defense, I like that by being moderate, if that truly means that you're taking all the issues and looking at them individually and you have a different response for each one, more power to you. I think that's great, but I think you're probably more the exception than the rule. This is my opinion. I don't have anything to back it up with, but I swear that the majority or a significant number of moderates are just saying that because it sounds cool and they really haven't thought through all the issues. But I'm going to go ahead and say that's not Mark, because he said otherwise, so I believe him.
And, you know, to remove the curtain a little bit, Mark's actually a friend of both of ours, and I think you're actually quite right when you say that he's not using it as a cop-out, even though a lot of people do. So be a moderate. It's cool if that's what... And, you know, a lot of my best friends are moderates. You know, I got no problem with that. Thanks for the comment, Mark.
Yeah, thanks.
We've got another comment, this one from Adam on the website. He says, I do wonder if you weren't a bit hasty to make more of ClimateGate than is truly there. I think it says a ton about how some unscrupulous philosopher king scientists act. Not sure it completely discredits the idea that it behooves us to move away from carbon-based fuels. As a true political independent, I have no a priori stance here, and I'm happy to let it sort out. I've never found the extremes on this issue, and indeed perhaps most issues, all that persuasive, as there often seems to be the all-too-predictable overplaying of the hand. Maybe I'll take first stab at this one. When I read that, I feel like there were two things going on when we talked about ClimateGate. One was just a very loud, vocal eye-rolling about scientists and just kind of throwing our hands up and being just kind of pissed off that this type of thing would happen. And so that tone came off as very dismissive and skeptical of the whole climate change movement. And I [S2] Right. [S1] I can get that people want to not let us off the hook for that. At the same time, when it actually came down to where we were netting out on what to do, I think we were pretty careful, and I still kind of stand by where we said we were. Basically, we said that, at least I said, and I think you were kind of along with me, this makes us less willing to adopt overexpensive policies that may or may not work, especially if the science is less solid than they say it is. But to clarify, and especially to respond to what Adam says, I'm all for things that help us move away from carbon-based fuels. That was the specific thing that Adam talked about. I'm especially very sympathetic to what people like Thomas Friedman and others say on this, and there are lots of reasons to work for energy innovation, including economic and geopolitical reasons. I'm all for it. If we can find a way to do it, that's awesome. What I'm not into are... It seems like a lot of the things that are proposed about climate change are these grand, you know, self-flagellation policies. It's like to punish us for benefiting at the expense of the planet. Like, we don't know if it's going to work, but at least we are reducing our way of life as a just desserts for how bad of people we've been. And I'm just not into that type of thing.
So limiting CO2 output sounds like a fantastic idea. And to make it go down or even to level out is going to be very hard to do. I feel like if we're going to take seriously the dance of forcing change in a very painful way, that scientists that really screwed this up and really wanted to force the thinking of the people are going to get a backlash from those that find out about it, who are going to all of a sudden be more skeptical and say, listen, I agree with you that there's a problem, we need to address it, but now that you tried to fake your way through making it like it's an apocalyptic issue that we're dealing with, I'm going to push back and deal with it in an even more practical way than the solution, which is going to be very painful. Going back to what you were saying, Logan, though, I totally agree that incentivizing research and development in the areas of energy usage is really the key here. Doing anything to curb or slow down or reverse the amount of energy we use, to me, that's like a non-starter. I mean, it's not a bad idea, but to make any sort of shift there that is necessary, I just saw on a show recently that there are some people who are suggesting other solutions like geoengineering. There are ways to slow it down or change global warming by basically running a hose into the sky or other solutions. But again, this disappoints the environmental crowd, the more purist of you out there that say like, oh, society deserves its just punishment for all of the pollution we use. This has to be a painful thing. We can't have our cake and eat it too. And that's the part that I don't necessarily subscribe to. Yeah, maybe we've used more energy and there are reasons we should be punished. But then again, what? If there's a way to fix it and it doesn't punish everyone, then I'm going to go with that solution. But that's not really replying to Adam's comment as much as expounding on what we were talking about before. But thanks for giving me the opportunity by leaving a comment, Adam.
So thanks, Adam, too. Thanks to both of you for your comments. And again, if you'd like to leave a comment on this podcast or any other, we'd love to hear it, and we'd love to respond to it in an upcoming podcast.
Bob's Tech Report.
Time for the Tech Report. Talk to us, Bob.
Today, I wanted to point us to two announcements coming out of Google. The first one is the Nexus One, which is the code name of the Google phone that is supposedly coming out in January. Right now, Google employees are confirmed to have these hot little devices in their hands. They're testing them over the holidays. From what I understand, most employees got a free phone from Google. And the difference here is, whereas Google already has Google phones via their Android operating system, which is the underlying code and the look and feel of a lot of phones out there. I own one of them, the G1, and the most recent Droid that's getting a lot of good positive buzz. This new Google phone is an unlocked GSM phone that consumers would be able to order directly from Google and then choose which carrier they want. And Google would work more closely with the manufacturer to make this phone more iPhone-esque. Like, it's from start to finish, it's designed for Google's operating system. Google was involved in the process of choosing the hardware and the integration. And in a lot of ways, it'll make for a better experience. So I'll stop there in terms of setup. I wanted to just comment on a few things. I think Google is trying to have its cake and eat it too. So they have an operating system that can be used by any manufacturer of phones, and then they want to have their own phone, so they want to partner with the same people they want to compete with to add a third dimension to the cake that they're eating. They're also open sourcing everything, so developers can take the code and spin it around like you can in the open source world and have it be different code from the originating code. So when other developers who are making applications to run on all these Google phones, be it the ones that Google makes or the manufacturers make, they're going to run into issues when developing software, because they can't just develop it once and assume it's going to work on every Google phone, because the Google phones are so open and different versions of everything is flying around there.
A lot of cake you've been throwing around. For one, I'd like to hear you say more about what this means for the other phones that use Android, if Google is actually jumping into the fray and competing with like the G1 or the Droid.
I'm not sure. Yeah, that's confusing to me, because it feels like it changes everything. But then again, I don't have precedent to say, oh, you know, look into the past when such and such company did this too, where they had their own operating system and their own branded phone at the same time. Google's sort of experimenting on this one. We don't know if it's a bad thing all the way. It could be that there are still good reasons to use the phone that comes with the carriers. For one, the carriers can subsidize them and offer them more directly and incentivize you to use their phones that they're probably
sharing
the
profits.
Yeah, exactly. And for another, in the end, carriers make the most money off of getting you to subscribe and having you pay a monthly fee. So whether or not you bought a phone directly from Google and then you chose the carrier, or you got the phone via the carrier offering you a deal, as long as the carrier is locking you in as a customer, I guess the issue is Google is sort of taking this Switzerland approach of like, oh, the consumer chooses their own carrier, which puts more burden on the carrier to have a reason to have a consumer choose them other than like, check out this cool phone we have with your deal that when you sign up. So I don't know.
One of the things that I am excited about, though, is, you know, if I had the choice of Google programming the operating system or being more involved in the application design, I'd much more like to see them involved in the application design. That's where their core competency, you know, their strength is. And so I feel like that's going to be the more credible competition to Apple, for example. So I'm excited about that, to see what's going on there.
Yeah, in theory, this phone could be some serious competition to the iPhone. It's too early to tell. We have more than theory right now. Reality is I think Android devices already are pretty good competition for Apple, but this could step it up a notch in theory. I guess we'll wait and see. So the other news out of Google that I wanted to point to actually isn't news out of Google. It's more news out of TechCrunch and some other tech blogs that have confirmed sources, so I'm running with it. Well, the news that is official is that Google already has their own operating system called Google Chrome OS. Interesting for a couple of reasons. One is that it's a different operating system than Android, which is the one that they use for phones. So Google is a company that has not made operating systems before, and all of a sudden, they're going to make two different ones. That's kind of weird, in my opinion, especially when nowadays everything's sort of converging. It seems like it would have made more sense to have an operating system that is platform agnostic. It works on the phone or the computer. So I think that's going to be an uphill battle for them. Microsoft didn't make their billions of dollars overnight by starting with two operating systems when they got into this business. That would have been a non-starter at that time anyway. So
since you brought up Microsoft, I just want to throw in that this is a really big bite that Google is trying to chew off. Because if we know anything from Microsoft's experience, operating systems are not easy to get right. And two, this is Microsoft's wheelhouse that they're trying to invade. This is what Microsoft is excellent at. So this is kind of a big deal, it seems like to me.
Yeah, I mean, 9 out of 10 computers run Microsoft operating systems. There's a reason for that. And the skeptics will say, oh, we're all forced to and it sucks. Yeah, well, you're an Apple fanboy if you're saying that. Well, not exactly. I shouldn't say that.
Windows isn't perfect. I mean, I think it's fair to say. But right. It's hard to do.
Yeah, it's hard to do, and it works with all sorts of hardware and software. Your options are endless. That's the reason it's not perfect, is because Microsoft doesn't control all the different pieces of the puzzle when you unbox your computer and set it up for yourself. Microsoft's only one piece of it, and for them to work on thousands of devices with different configurations is actually pretty amazing. And so this brings me to Google's way of dealing with it. They want to partner specifically, and this confirmed report out of TechCrunch is saying that we're going to see a Google brand again, netbook of sorts that's ready for holiday season 2010, which is going to be Google working more closely with the particular hardware manufacturer to release a netbook that's like a Google netbook. So a couple of things. One is, yeah, that works for phones, at least for the iPhone. I don't know that that's going to work for computers. I think it's going to be Google's computer, which is one, versus like the thousands of Microsoft Windows-based computers, which are like unlimited in customization needs, compared to Google's one entering the market. So I don't know how big of a chunk of the market they're going to be able to take by this strategy. And then the other thing is, again, having their cake and eating it too, they also want their new operating system to work with whatever computers. But they want their operating system to be browser-based. So you boot up your computer and it goes straight to the browser. It's very light. It doesn't really run complex programs like Photoshop, AutoCAD, or anything that's beyond like your basic apps that your average user would use. This thing won't be designed for that, and even those, a lot of them will be in question. And then there's the whole issue of drivers. Google's already stated that they're not really going to support all devices out there like Microsoft does. They want to work more specifically with certain ones, which is going to confuse people who see a Google option into having to deal with, like, well, what does it work with? What does it not work with? So long story short, wish Google the best. I'm interested to see where this goes. I'm a fan of competition. I'll probably follow it closely and play with it, but I'm not so sure that it's going to do much in the marketplace as I'm understanding it right now.
Yeah, well, I just want to echo what you just said. Love the competition. In the end, it can only be great for us as consumers. Whatever sort of things they get right will probably become standard in future operating systems. Wherever you get your operating system, more choice is good. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, sounds good.
culture update.
We've tried to avoid it, but it's just gotten too big and too weird. Bill Simmons has called it the biggest sports story of the decade. What are we talking about? The Tiger Woods saga. So, here we are. To help all our listeners keep up to date on issues of cultural relevance, we thought we'd take a quick look at the story and give our takes. What happened? Basically, it started with this bizarre turn of events the week of Thanksgiving. The Tuesday before Thanksgiving, the National Enquirer reported that Tiger had been seeing another woman. Uh-oh. Then Thanksgiving night, or Friday morning, Tiger was in a bizarre car accident. He hit a tree and a fire hydrant, basically right outside his own driveway. Tiger's wife broke the rear window in the vehicle with a golf club. Now, we don't know if this was before or after the crash. Maybe it was the Freedom? I mean, who knows? Neighbors found Tiger lying next to his crashed vehicle, shoeless and snoring. He was out for about 6 minutes. Tiger refused to be interviewed by the police for 3 days when they came to ask him some questions, specifically about domestic violence. He refused to let him inside the house. And the other sort of bizarre thing about that night was that the accident happened at 2:30 a.m. on the Thursday night, Friday morning, and it somehow was not leaked to the media for about 13 hours. And then since that, a lot of other things have come out. Tiger made this generic public apology to family and fans. He actually announced that he's taking a break from golf indefinitely.
That's right.
And apparently his wife, Elin, is that how you say it? Is now,
I don't know. Yeah.
Seeking a divorce. Have you heard anything else?
It is confirmed that he's had more than one relationship. It's not just like one girl that he fell in love with, like that one weird governor.
Oh, that's a good point. A lot of girls, really.
Yeah, there are a lot of girls, and it's more about paying for sex type stuff. It's not like he had any deep, meaningful relationships. And he, I've heard, would shell out upwards of like $60,000 for an evening with whichever girl of his choice or stuff like that. Now, I'm going to say, I don't know how accurate all that is, but it's kind of phase two of the saga, right?
Right.
So what do you think about this, Logan? What's your gut reaction?
Well,
are we wasting people's time?
I mean, I guess my reaction, maybe there are three things I want to say about my reaction. In an ideal world, this is the type of thing that would be between Tiger and his wife and the 20 other girls he's seeing or whatever. But I kind of roll my eyes at society about our prudishness, about, whoa, people have sex or people aren't completely faithful. Yeah, it's the real world. Maybe it'd be nice if it didn't happen, but that's what happens. It's between them. Second, though, we're totally not in that ideal world. When you're a public figure, a celebrity, you just got to expect that people are going to be fascinated. And the third thing, this is sort of deliciously weird and bizarre, everything that's come out. That incident of that night, that's just, you can't make that up. And just the way he's handled it, he's not handled it really well. So he's kind of asking for it in the way everything's come out.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, before this happened, he was already kind of notorious for wanting to have his cake and eat it too. That's like the third time I've used this analogy. But basically, he's the first billionaire sports guy, and he makes a point of like naming his yacht Privacy. And he has this thing of like, oh, my privacy, that's so important to me. Well, obviously not as important as having sex with multiple chicks, because those two don't really jive together. It's just a matter of time before one's going to give over the other, right?
Although I will say, he's like written the book on how not to have an affair. Texts that can be traced, leaving voicemails
right.
That are easily savable, and you can give them to the National Enquirer. It's kind of hard to deny things like that.
Well, I think this speaks to his whole idealistic view of privacy, right? Oh, I'm entitled to the same privacy as everyone else, which, you know, your average person doesn't have to watch their back as much as a celebrity to lead a private life. But if you're a celebrity, wake up call, if you're listening and this is your first time to hear this, yeah, privacy is a little bit of a tougher thing for you. And that's just kind of goes with the practice. But then at the same time, my libertarian tendencies kick in, and I feel like you were saying, okay, so the dude slept with some women, and he plays golf really well. Sure, that's not the first time that's happened.
Yeah, and we like him because he's a great golfer, not because he's a great human being, you know?
Well, men like him because he's a great golfer. I feel like maybe women...
Sure.
And all of a sudden, this comes out, and I think guys are going to be like, well, Tiger Woods on the Xbox, that game's still fun. They're not going to, like, stop playing it because of this whole episode. But women, they're going to, like, not buy it for their husbands. I'm painting with a broad brush, and I could be wrong.
Now, the one other thing I wanted to say on this is I actually heard an interview. Someone, I think it was Dan Patrick, got on James Carville, of all people, and he asked him about what Tiger Woods should do. Now, James Carville, to refresh your memory, was a big-time political advisor to Bill Clinton, so he's actually got some expertise in how to deal with sex scandals for a public figure. And James right. Carville said, basically, Tiger, just don't say anything about it, which was kind of the Bill Clinton strategy. Go out and be a fantastic golfer. You'll get through it. It's kind of interesting.
Whatever you do, don't define the word is. Stay away from that.
Right. In any case, that's kind of the opposite of what Tiger's doing. He's taking time away from golf. If he were to come back and just be a kick-ass golfer again, maybe we'd be able to forget about this and change our most recent associations with Tiger Woods.
Kind of like riding, he's like in the middle. He's like, I don't know what to say. I'm going to sit on it for a few days, and then I'm going to say something very ambiguous, and then I'm going to say something after another report comes out and respond to that. Like, he's not staying quiet, but he's not speaking up either. He's kind of, I don't know, he's in that unhealthy middle ground that makes people like us talk about it in a way that...
He's a moderate, basically.
On that note, what goes around comes around. I love it. Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe that's enough about Tiger. A couple weeks ago, we talked about movies, and now we've seen a few of those, so maybe I thought we'd revisit that in the little time we have left. You, especially, I've been following your Twitter feed. You've been on a tear seeing movies the last couple weeks.
Oh, man, December is a good month for movies, and this one especially. Yeah, for whatever reason, I've been enjoying myself. It's been fun.
So, Up in the Air, that was one of the ones that we had our eye on, and now we've both seen it.
Yeah, what did you think? I loved it. I could go into more. I want to hear what you think.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. The first thing I'll say is I think our fears of it being a George Clooney weird movie did not come true, so that's
not
good. It was George Clooney playing George Clooney to some extent, but on the other hand, I like George Clooney. So that was fine with me.
Right.
This was, what's his name, Jason Reitman?
Yeah, Jason Reitman, his third major movie after Thank You for Smoking and Juno.
And I think all three are great.
Agree. Yeah, where he's 3 for 3. So I think this gets a practically ideal thumbs up. That's kind of cheesy. We'll have to come up with something better. But I say go see it if you haven't. That's a great movie to see if you're looking for one.
It had kind of a subtle and complicated plot, which is always the type of thing I like. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what to make of the ending. It didn't really resolve in the happiest or the most satisfying way, but on the other hand, sometimes I like that. I really loved Anna Kendrick's character, Natalie. I thought she was great in playing that,
yes.
That young...
Fresh out of business school.
Thinks she knows all the answers, and she is really smart, but also super inexperienced. In life and business, she did a really great job there.
Yeah, and I liked how the movie had, I don't want to spoil anything, so I'll just leave it at maybe a twist or two, at least for me. It didn't play out like I had thought it would. I had seen the first half. The way I thought the second half might happen, it was quite a bit different, but in a good way.
But I liked it a lot.
It was enjoyable. So what else? Let's see. I saw the movie in Education,
uh-huh.
which I mentioned briefly, and it's a coming-of-age story. Young girl who's only 16 meets up with a older gentleman who's kind of a playboy of sorts, but is a very charming guy, and she thinks she's figured out her life and wants to go do things in the way that you would when you're with a rich older gentleman, hang out, go to parties and stuff, but then she is in for some surprises and gets an education.
Dun, dun, dun.
Anyway, it's a fun movie. It's actually a pretty light movie for dealing with heavy themes. I think that's to its credit. It deals with the plight of women in the 60s. Basically, if you choose this route and go with a guy who's successful, it's not like you really get to do what you want to do. But if you choose the route of an education in the traditional sense, in the 60s especially, some would say still even now a little bit, you don't get to do what you want to do as a woman either. And it sort of plays with that. And I like that a lot.
Sort of Mad Men type theme, sounds like.
Yeah, a little bit, actually. That's a good point.
I saw Broken Embraces.
Yeah, tell me more. What's the deal with that movie?
Almodovar and Penelope Cruz. It was good. I don't know if I knew entirely what to expect, but I enjoyed it a lot. It's about a Spanish filmmaker who has had this wild adventure through life, including Penelope Cruz's character in the past, and then loose ends from the past come back, and they meet him in the present, and he navigates all of that. So it's kind of two stories in one there. Penelope Cruz is fantastic, very sexy, and very, I don't know, the way she always is with Almodóvar, just very fun to watch. And I'm really coming to the conclusion that I like a lot of foreign movies, but I really like Spanish movies or Italian movies, I think, more than, say, French French movies, because even though it's weird, slight cultural differences, there's a lot of emotion and passion, and even if it's a bit overwrought, everything's life and death, it seems like, in a movie like this. I can still relate to it somehow and enjoy the ride it's taking me on. So
very nice. Would you say, I mean, you know me pretty well, would you say I'd like it? Netflix is booking it as a foreign thriller, and I'm adding it to my queue now, so...
Have you watched anything else by Pedro Almodóvar?
I've seen Volver.
Yeah, Volver, that's the duo again, and if you like that, you should like this.
I did, and that was a very good movie.
Yeah, if you like that, then that's probably all the recommendation you need. I'd say see it.
Okay, cool.
Thanks for listening. To comment on anything you heard today, visit elbow.com. That's LBEAUX.com, where you can download this and future episodes. Or send us an email at practicallyideal@elbow.com. You can also find us on iTunes. Practically Ideal is recorded and produced by Logan Bell. The intro and outro music and the music before the pop culture update is by The Emergence. Check them out at myspace.com/onegreatc. The music before the first two segments and before Bob's Tech Report is by Charles Jiske. If you like what you've heard, you can find more from him at charlesjiske.com. charlesjiske.com. Links to both The Emergence and Charles Jiske are available on the website.